We have a quorum. We're going to call this meeting to order. Representative Powell, you've reviewed the minutes. Would you like to make a motion? Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Wilken, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 2805, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Government Operations Committee.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to do a quick walkthrough of the bill, and then my witnesses can fill in any gaps that I leave. Article 1 is basically aimed at Securian, allowing them to go from a mutual holding company to a mutual insurance company, and they need this for competitive reasons. They do have someone here to testify if members have questions. Article 2 is probably the biggest chunk of the bill, and that's the Interstate Compact. And that's basically, this is a response to federal legislation that has been introduced to federalize the regulation of insurance. People have been reading up on insurance over the summer, and I'm sure you all have because it's a riveting subject, but it's called the Federal Smart Act. And this is basically a state response to keep state regulation. And it basically forms a compact with other states to have a single filing point for insurance products for all the states within the compact. It's supported by both the NCSL and NCOIL. It sets a standard for how products are drafted with, I believe that's an NAIC model. This compact has already been adopted by 21 other states, and it needs to have at least 26 states to become operational. Article 3 is a miscellaneous section. Section 1 of that allows the notice of the surplus lines notices on policies, instead of being stamped in red ink, it can be in black ink. Section 2 makes it so that an insurance holding company, when they file their annual registration, it can be June 1 instead of March 1, requested by the St. Paul companies. The routine practice have been to get extensions, and this just kind of gets into effect what has become de facto normal process, just because of the extensions. If I think I've covered that correctly. Sections 3 and 4 allow a slight broadening of how 5 of the continuing ed requirements for insurance producers can be satisfied, and to include ethics, privacy protection, and customer and client software. And the final provision authorizes fraternals with commissioner approval to reinsure other fraternals. And that's pretty much it. I will let my witnesses add whatever remarks they would like.
Please state your name for the record.
Robin Rowan with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. House File 2805 represents a coordinated effort between agents, brokers, insurers, and fraternal societies, including the Sons of Norway, the Catholic Aid Association, Knights of Columbus, Woodmen of the World, Modern Woodmen, Independent Order of Foresters, Degree of Honor, and Thrive Financial for Lutherans. And this legislation represents a continuation of a bipartisan effort to keep Minnesota-based insurers competitive nationally, and to continue to modernize the business of insurance while growing insurance jobs and maintaining the high level of consumer protection that Minnesota is known for. I'm going to focus my other remarks on Article 2, which is the most significant. We'd be happy to answer questions on any of the other articles as well. The world for life insurers, people may not have noticed, but it's changed drastically within the last decade. And no longer are life insurers just competing with each other, but they now operate in a financial services marketplace with brokers, mutual funds, and banks. And despite this new marketplace, it can still take years for a life insurer to get products to market nationally. In addition, in this increasingly mobile society, life products are often bought in one state, people move to another, and the products aren't used until years later. So there, it makes a lot of sense in the life industry to talk about uniform standards nationally. As Representative Wilkin mentioned, Congress has paid significant attention to the life insurance marketplace in particular, and has really issued an ultimatum to the state that either you work on uniformity and modernize the regulatory environment, or we're going to subject you to federal oversight. And I think most legislators and regulators would tell you that federal oversight of insurance is probably not the best way to go. So the NAIC, in conjunction with consumers, the industry, and legislators through NCSL and NCOIL, got together and tried to determine the best way to make the marketplace more efficient, preserve state and preserve state regulation at the same time, and protect consumers. And what they came up with was this interstate compact. Should Minnesota be one of the states that join it, they would play a role in developing these uniform standards, and the result would be a far more efficient process for life insurance products to get to market. We need 26 states, and it's expected that this will happen this year. Those are my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Beckins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the. Could you move that chair?
Okay.
I like to be able to see somebody when I'm talking to them. I'm an author on the bill. I support uniformity. I understand that the overall threat is that if we don't do something, the feds will do it to us. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, yes, that is very fair.
And my question then, Mr. Chair, would be, how do we prevent this from dumbing down our ability to regulate the industry? Maybe dumbing down is a bad term for it, but becoming less strict or doing less to protect our own consumers. How do we make sure that that doesn't happen when we essentially give our authority, not necessarily give our authority, but look to a larger group to adopt these uniform standards?
Ms. Rubin.
Chairman, Representative Atkins, very fair question. The compact will be comprised of the chief regulators of all the member states. They are very much committed to maintaining an exceedingly high level of regulation. The purpose of this is not to go to the lowest denominator, but to create uniform standards in a single point of filing. There have been, the NAIC has worked to put together a prototype of standards thus far so people can kind of see what they would look like. And to date, based on a review of our companies, the standards are equal to or more stringent than current Minnesota law. And in the compact itself, there are certain standards that the uniform standards have to meet. And they can't be lesser than, they must provide equal or greater protection than current NAIC models.
Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and as the author, would it be fair to say that we either do this or somebody's going to do it for us? And if somebody's going to do it for us, we may not like so much.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be very fair to say. And even more so than they'll do it for us, they'll be out of our hands.
They'll do it to us.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So we as a state have more control going this direction than letting the feds take it.
That's right. If the feds take over, Mr. Chairman, we're pretty much out of the business of insurance regulation, and if we want more stringent protection, we'll probably be preempted by the federal law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Spezzetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dominic Spezzetto. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and also the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. We are in very strong support of this legislation, and I'd like to make comments on just two sections of the bill. First of all, Article 2, the compact provision, which you've heard, not only addresses the issue of getting insurance policy annuity products to market in a timely fashion. For our standpoint as agents, it's a very important effort that we make to show Congress that we as states can regulate insurance in an efficient and simple manner. And one of the reasons I think that we're facing this federal regulatory issue is the fact that we do have 50 states, 50 different jurisdictions, 50 different statutes, 50 different commissioners. And I think in order to maintain state regulation, which is our goal, and frankly the insurance agents are very strongly in support of state regulation, that's not true with all the insurance carriers. There are carriers that are interested in federal regulation, frankly, because it's simpler for them. But we want to maintain state regulation, particularly as it relates to things like agent conduct, marketing practices, licensing provisions, because we do not want to have a federal system. And part of Representative Atkins' question relates not only to the product, but to how the product is sold, how it's marketed, and how agents relate to that product. And all of that would still be maintained by the state under the compact. So the state would still have regulatory authority over the agents and agent conduct and their marketing conduct. So I think that's very important. And frankly, we want the state and the state legislature to be the entity that we deal with on those particular issues. So that provision is very, very important for us. The second provision I want to mention is a change in our continuing education law. And this is in the last section of the bill, Article 3. When continuing education was passed in 1974, it was obviously a different world. And in fact, we had prohibited some things in 1974 that probably aren't even appropriate now, but it's an issue that we want to address. We prohibited things such as speed reading and typing, the use of calculators, how to deal with office machines. The insurance world has changed rather dramatically. It used to be a paper world where we had a lot of paper that was handed back and forth, and people signed things, and there were a lot of documents. Now a lot of this stuff is generated over the Internet. We get most of our insurance rates and quotes, policies, riders, all the information that we get is now Internet-based. And we would like to be able to open the continuing education law to allow agents to learn more about how to use the Internet effectively for their policyholders and for their insurance business. So we think it's just stepping up into the 21st century by eliminating some of the prohibitions that have been determined that keep us from doing things such as Internet-based continuing education, things like best practices, Internet rating, how to look up companies' best practice or their solvency and their financial considerations over the Internet and other things like that. So we'd like to make this minor change in the law to allow us to pursue at least 5 hours of these types of education within our 30 hours of required education. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Yeah, this is for Representative Wilkin and Mr. Spicetto. Page 32, line 1, I'm wondering if you would entertain an oral amendment that would include personal and safety awareness as a area that could be included for continuing ed. And in particular, the reason why I have that emphasis, if an agent goes out and inspects a house, let's particularly say somebody more vulnerable, maybe some women in particular, I want them to be aware of some of the dangers that sometimes are there with some people that are there. And I think as a course, I want to know if you guys would consider that as an area that could be included in that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm open to that amendment.
Okay, but I'd like to make an oral amendment that 32.1 after personal after privacy protection, comma, we would add personal and safety awareness, comma, to include one other area that could be included for continuing education. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Any more questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wilkins, just still trying to absorb I understand we're kind of in a rock and a hard place in terms of options. I don't feel that I'd want uniform federal standards. But at the same time, I'm a little concerned about the depth of what we're giving away here, in that we have often enacted uniform standards that have been multi-state efforts to develop good law, model laws, and I think that's worked really effectively. And this is a new approach, as I understand it, where this new compact will come up with proposals, and they will become the law of the land in the participating states within 90 days of their being promulgated. And so we kind of get out of a lot of the traditional roles that we have had as policymakers. And I have a question then, kind of the follow-up to that, but is that a correct understanding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we still maintain some control there. The if for some reason a product came online that we didn't like here in Minnesota, you can introduce legislation that says you can't sell that here. There are steps, and I believe the commissioner would have rulemaking authority, and maybe my witnesses can correct me if I'm wrong, but we still have, there's still backstops. If there, we think there's not enough consumer protection in a given product, we can basically say no, not here.
Ms. Broom?
Well, to that point, when something's initiated and approved by the compact, will that negate existing state law? For example, provisions that we have on rating bans on health insurance and underwriting criteria. I understand we get to have input into the sales agents and their protections, but I'm just trying to understand if existing state law actually gets superseded by this.
Ms. Room?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler. Yes and no. The delegation to the compact is very limited. Legislators will get notice of before any standard is promulgated. So this committee, actually, the Insurance Committee and the Senate and House will get notice so they can participate in the rulemaking process. But more importantly than that, it's really just the content of life insurance products that are affected by the compact. So it's not health insurance, and underwriting guidelines, even for life insurance products, would still be the purview of the state because they determine the eligibility of someone to buy the product, and it's really just the content, the form, that is determined, governed by the compact standards.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. On page 22, and I'm trying to find the exact line, it appears that we only have an option. It's lines 22, page 22, line 23, in terms of the state being able to opt out regarding long-term care insurance products, and it appears that such an opt-out is effective at the time of enactment of the compact by the compacting state. So it appears to me right now that we need to make a decision now as we apply for membership whether we want them to look at long-term care and adhere to their long-term care policies or not. And I have a real concern about that because we're modifying our health and human services proposals to take advantage of some new federal opportunities for partnership on long-term care. You've dealt with seniors in your community. Buying long-term care insurance is incredibly complicated and confusing for many individuals, and I'm just thinking that this is an area that we haven't really done as much work as I would hope we would, and I'm not quite sure where this group might go with it. And it seems to me if they develop a product that we like, we can always opt in or we can adopt it. But since we do have an option of opting out of at least this line of business, I would encourage us to do this. But I'd like reactions to that.
Ms. Room?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, you can, in fact, opt out of long-term care coverage up front. If the state doesn't like the standards that the compact develops, you can also opt out along the line as well. It just provides you the option of an upfront opt-out for that particular line of insurance. But with respect to long-term care, the language specifically states that the protections of the compact have to be at the same level of or greater than the NAIC standards, which is what we currently have in Minnesota now. And it wouldn't affect our ability to comply with the long-term care partnership, which is a very important initiative that our company supports as well.
Representative Loeffler.
And I'll make this my last follow-up on this, but I'm really trying to understand what we're committing to long-term and what our flexibility is. And on page 22, on point 4 at the top, line 3, is the opt-out procedure. And it appears to me that we're giving all the authority to the commissioner to make some key decisions with some really tight time frames, because it says if you decide to opt out of a uniform standard by regulation, it must A, give written notice to the commission no later than 10 business days after the uniform standard is promulgated, or at the time they become a compacting state. 10 days is a very short time frame to evaluate any kind of option, particularly when I suspect in the rulemaking, it'll be like rulemaking here. There'll be all kinds of competing proposals, and they'll settle on something. And for And then it appears that the authorizing agent on all of this opt-out provision is the commissioner, which is the Commissioner of Commerce. So it's not a legislative or a policy decision. It's a decision of a gubernatorial appointee who may or may not have interest in life insurance or long-term care insurance. Their expertise might be in property. For them to in 10 days make a decision about whether or not it meets our state's needs is a really short time frame and kind of an interesting precedent, particularly since I don't think we're guaranteed significant voting authority in this new entity. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Laughlin, no, that's not correct. The commissioner will have a vote on this, so it won't come to him sight unseen. He'll be in the here as designee, I believe, will be part of the development of this. So the 10 days, I don't think will create a significant hurdle because I've been involved in probably a fairly lengthy discussion on the adoption of those numbers.
Representative Mowry, you still have a question?
Pardon?
I still have a question?
I think the question has been answered. I was going to ask if this was an opt-in or an opt-out, and it seems to be you're definitely an opt-out, and I guess I prefer an opt-in much more like uniform law commissions or something where you develop it nationally and then each state opts in. And I would much prefer a bill like that.
Representative Mullery, I guess the bottom line is the way the interstate compacts work, either do this exact wording or you don't participate in the compact. It has to be fairly exact. I don't think we can make adjustments.
Representative Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wilkin, then, does that mean that the states that have opted in so far or have passed this legislation so far have passed it exactly word for word like this legislation is?
Ms. Room or Dominic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, only with very minor alterations.
But there have been minor.
Very minor. In terms of specifying that the commissioner is the member that serves on the commission, that's one allowable. The interstate compact, the way it works, is like it's a contract, and you have to agree to it in a substantially similar fashion. Otherwise, it's considered a rejection of the original offer, and that's interstate compact law.
Representative Wilkin, any more comments?
Nope. I renew my motion that House File 2805 as amended be recommended passed and be referred to the Government Operations Committee.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. I believe Representative Coles, you're presenting your bill next.
Okay, we've got a little housekeeping to take care of first. The chair erred when we referred Representative Atkins' bill straight to the floor. He gets the opportunity to visit the Civil Law Committee, so congratulations to Representative Atkins. So the chair will move that we reconsider the original vote to pass House File 2514, and then we'll bring it back before us and send it to civil. So all in favor of recalling the House File 2514, say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins moves that House File 2514 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee. You okay with that?
I do. No place I'd rather go, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'm sure. Have fun there. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion prevails. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2843 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Representative Coles moves that House File 2843 be recommended passed and referred to Civil Law.
Representative Atkins just told me I can join him there, so I'm looking forward to it.
It'll be a fun time, I'm sure. Representative Cole, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm back with the ID theft bill that I presented to the Joint Commerce and Civil Law Committee hearing just before session began. As I mentioned, then over the past several years, I've become more and more interested in the concerns and the problems that exist for individuals and consumers, and frankly for businesses as well, in the ever-evolving world of identity fraud and financial fraud. But I have to say, over the past few weeks, I've questioned my sanity a little bit in bringing this bill forward, because I think I've met with pretty much every lobbyist in St. Paul, both business folks and consumer folks who seem to have an interest in this bill and making sure that it's right. And that's really what my intention is here today. But I do want to thank everybody who has stopped by. It's been interesting to learn more about these issues and try to come up with a bill that hopefully will provide some real protections for Minnesota consumers. We heard a lot of testimony a couple weeks ago when we had our joint hearing, and I'm not going to have a parade of witnesses up here to reiterate what you heard before. Obviously, identity theft is a serious issue that we're all concerned about as policymakers. There are a number of people here who may want to speak on the bill or particular amendments, and I know there's a lot of experts in the room who can answer any technical questions that I may not be able to answer. I'm going to go through the bill section by section. There's a few amendments that I'd suggest that we take as we go through the bill, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right with you. I didn't go through the bill section by section. I kind of did a high level when we were here several weeks ago. Mr. Chairman, Section 1 of the bill requires that appropriate safeguards be used when data is destroyed by the state that contains confidential or private data. And, Mr. Chairman, the first amendment that I'd like to ask the committee to take a look at is A3.
Representative Coles moves the A3 amendment. Representative Coles?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I decided to do these individual amendments instead of doing a delete everything, because I want to make sure people understand what it is we're doing. And Katie Engler from the Department of Administration helped me with this language. If people have specific questions, basically what we're doing is we're cleaning up and doing some cross-referencing with the language on line 8 through 13. We're dealing with the issue of what the data that is a part of the application for the identity theft passport, how it's to be treated and classified, and it refers to the new identity theft passport section that's in the bill that we'll talk about in a little more detail later. It's a fairly technical amendment, Mr. Chairman, simply to clean up the classification of the data.
Okay, I'm going to try to remember to ask for public testimony in each of these as they come up. Just we took a lot of testimony on the identity theft issues previously, so I don't want to go back through testimony with committee members' time right now, but if someone in the public has any testimony in favor of or in opposition to this, the A3 amendment, please speak now or forever hold your peace, or at least until civil law. Seeing none, members have any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 2 of the bill deals with the concept of security freezes on credit reports regarding minors. The last thing that we'll talk about is a more robust security freeze. Representative Dabney and Davids had a security freeze provision that was not in my bill originally. We're going to talk about that in a minute because I have an amendment to do that. But with regard to the security freeze on minors, I don't believe I have an amendment. I thought I had one. What we're allowing people to do is if mom or dad want to freeze a credit report for one of their children, they can go ahead and do that. There's concerns not only with financial theft with regard to minors and making sure those credit reports are locked up if mom and dad want it, but there's also issues of kids abusing credit cards and credit. And there's also the issue of minors' identities actually being stolen for work documents or other types of identity fraud. after somebody establishes an identity with a minor, using a minor's identity. Part of the problem is it often goes undetected for many years, and so this provision, Section 2, would allow a parent to freeze their son or daughter's credit. Section 3, again, deals with records management and the destruction of records by the state. Section 4, is a provision related to the Representative Johnson's breach notification bill from last year. And I believe, Mr. Chairman, if you'll bear with me, I believe there's a... There's not an amendment to that one. I thought there was. My apologies. Section 5, Mr. Chairman, gets rid of the exemption for entities covered by the Federal HIPAA Act. As I mentioned a couple weeks ago, there was, and this relates to the breach notification as well, members. There was a thought last year when the bill passed that the federal government was going to be enacting rules related to breach notification for entities covered by HIPAA. That never came to pass, and so we are basically bringing those entities back into the breach notification bill that was passed last year. Section 6 deals with the requirement of businesses to properly dispose of any personal information. And members, there is the A4 amendment deals with that section. We're requiring that the businesses take reasonable steps to dispose of any personal information when they go about disposing it. What I didn't want to do, one of the issues that was brought to my attention is, obviously we have a number of entities, business entities, who are regulated by various regulators already. And some of those entities some of those regulations that are in place already deal with the destruction of data. What the amendment does, what the A4 amendment does, Mr. Chairman and members, is that it says if an entity is already subject to regulation, their current regulator is the one charged with enforcing this provision. And if there are already rules and regulations related to the disposal of personal information, those rules will in a sense govern. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A4 amendment.
Representative Coles moves the A4 amendment. Is there any testimony in favor or in opposition of this amendment? Is there any questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles. I just wonder if you could give us some examples. The question that really comes to my mind here is whether these various state agencies are all prepared and equipped to do that kind of enforcement.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think the short answer is yes. I mean, they're already doing it. They're already regulating these entities. They're already, take the case of a state-regulated bank. The bank examiner is already in there on a regular basis looking not only at what they're doing with information when it comes in, but they're looking at what's being done when it goes out. The fallback is if an entity is not currently being regulated, the Attorney General's office will still have the ability to enforce this provision. It's not my intent at all to have a provision out there that nobody can enforce. It's just it doesn't make sense to me to have multiple regulators or state entities, state offices enforcing the same provision, particularly when there's somebody already in place.
Representative Weidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Colt, I just wonder whether I hear what you're saying, but do all the various agencies have are we requiring different agencies to all become familiar with a new area of law, or are they going to all already be familiar enough to do this without too much additional prep? I guess I would call it. That's one follow-up question I have. And the other one is whether we wouldn't be better off to to leave in the section about the Attorney General enforcing, but maybe change the shall to a may so that it could be enforced in either place. I just think that we may see situations where we might want the Attorney General to be doing the enforcing, and whether your amendment here just takes that away in the case where there are other agencies that should do it.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I'm pretty sure that every regulated business will tell you that their regulator is tough, and they're breathing down their neck and making sure that they're doing the things that that we as the legislature set forth in terms of policy, and then the rules that the individual agencies promulgate. This is a fair, to a large extent, particularly with financial institutions and some of the existing entities where there is a lot of personal information. There's already rules in place, and they're already being enforced. Graham Leach Bliley has some protections. The banks tell me that they're already required to do some of these things. And so what I don't want to do is create kind of a inconsistency in terms of, There's two standards that somebody has to choose to figure out and to apply, and which one is it? I'm not terribly concerned about our state regulators and their enforcement abilities with regard to these provisions. I mean, they're out doing these regulatory examinations on an ongoing basis. All we're asking them to do is make sure that the entity that they're taking a look at, that they're examining, has the appropriate procedures and safeguards in place, and if not, to make sure they get there.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Foltz.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 7 deals with the credit freeze regarding minors. It's a little different than the security freeze, the credit report freeze. The A7 amendment, members, what this section does is it prohibits an entity from issuing credit to a minor. The A7 amendment seeks to insert the word knowingly on line 31. So it'll read, no creditor shall knowingly offer or provide credit to a minor. Here's the situation. Here's why the A7 amendment is before you. There's a concern that there may be, at times, the inadvertent issuance of credit. And, in fact, when we get to civil law, I'm going to have an amendment. We just weren't able to quite pin down the language to further define what we mean by credit in this provision. Here's a situation that could cause a problem if we don't address this issue. An individual, first of all, banks are required by state law to issue demand deposit accounts to minors. So if a kid has a job and wants to put $800-900 in a savings account, the bank has to open that account. Most of the banks offer ATM cards or check writing privileges on those accounts. And if a kid goes to the ATM on Friday evening after the machine's already offline and takes $40 out and they only have $35 in their account, one could argue that the financial institution just issued $5 of credit to the minor. That's not the situation. That's not what we're trying to go after or take care of. So this is to the A7 amendment seeks to make sure that we're dealing with the intentional issuance of credit, and there will be an amendment to further clarify, and there's a provision in Minnesota law right now that defines loan that looks promising in terms of how do we narrow this down. But it's going to be in civil law, and we'll deal with that issue specifically in civil law. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A7 amendment unless members have questions.
Is there any testimony from the public one way or another? Seeing none, is there any questions for members? Seeing none, all in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Section 8 deals with the issue of credit card offers being, or solicitations being mailed to one address and the application coming back from another address. This is potentially problematic for obvious reasons, but there's also a lot of good reasons why an application may come back from another address. If an individual has a business located at another address and they decide to apply for credit and try to use it for their business, and they use their business address as the one for the credit card. Or if an individual's moved, they get the application mailed to them at 123 Elm Street, and they move to 234 Spruce. The application gets forwarded to them there, and they return the application from 234 Spruce. We should allow them to get the credit card. So there are some good reasons why a card company may get an application from an address other than the one it mailed the application to. Of course, there are some obvious reasons why that could be problematic. That's what Section 8 intends to do. It seeks to require card issuing companies to verify the address of the individual prior to issuing the card if it does come back from an address different than the one to which the offer was sent. Mr. Chairman and members, the A6 Amendment seeks to clean this up a little bit. On page 6, line 5, we're deleting the word buy, and we're going to add before issuing a credit card. So it'll read, it'll require the credit card company to verify the change of address before issuing the credit card. And then we're deleting line 6. And the reason we're doing that, members, is there are all kinds of problems with attempting to actually there can be problems attempting to contact the person. There have been situations where an identity thief has not only stolen financial information but has cloned a cell phone. There are all kinds of situations where people may or may not have moved, and the card companies all have processes in place right now to verify these addresses, but we want to make sure that they're actually doing it. And they have a financial interest in verifying the address and making sure that a card's not issued to the wrong individual, because they're on the hook financially for financial fraud that occurs when they issue a card incorrectly. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A6 Amendment, unless members have questions.
Representative Coles moves the A6 Amendment. Is there any testimony in favor of or opposed? Seeing none, any questions from members? Seeing none, all in favor of the A6 Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Trying to move quickly, Mr. Chairman and members. Section 9 is the Identity Theft Passport. This is the provision that was in my bill a couple weeks ago. I talked about it briefly. Representative Emmer had a slightly different take on it. I decided to stay with my language for now. Representative Dabney had an interesting provision in his bill related to a declaration of innocence from the courts. In other words, somebody who was a victim of identity theft could go to the court and get a declaration of innocence. I kind of like the idea, but the more I talked with Representative Dabney and others about it, our courts don't ever declare somebody innocent. They find people, juries find people not guilty. I've talked to Representative Dabney about the changes that I'm making on my bill, and he understood that, so we're kind of moving away from the declaration of innocence idea, and we're going to stay with the identity theft passport. What this is, members, is it's a document, a piece of evidence that somebody can use to establish that they've been the victim of identity theft. And it can be used in a number of situations. It could be used for somebody who's trying to apply for some credit, and they may be in the process of cleaning up their identity theft problem, their credit history because of identity theft. So they can use this document to try to establish that they do in fact they are a good credit risk. The other thing that it can be used for is when somebody steals your identity, somebody who's willing to steal your identity may not be one of society's finer individuals, and they may run around and commit crimes. And there have been situations where individuals have been pulled off airplanes or arrested because somebody else has committed a crime and used their name when they get booked. And so people have had problems. This is a document that somebody can hold up to say, I've been the victim of identity theft. I'm not the one who defrauded Institution ABC. Section 10, members, is the skimming card fraud. I talked about that a lot a couple weeks ago. I won't reiterate that. Section 11 deals with a request to the Supreme Court that they consider changing the rules of evidence with regard to the introduction of financial reports for these types of for these types of crimes. And then, Mr. Chairman and members, the Eighth Amendment is the last amendment. Representative Dabney and Davis in their bill had a security freeze. Like I said, it wasn't in my bill with the exception of minors. I've talked with Representative Davis and Dabney and others, and I think that it makes a lot of sense to put in a security freeze into Minnesota law. Members, this is somewhat different than the Dabney proposal. It requires that an individual obtain a police report indicating that they have been the victim of identity theft and submit that police report along with their application to the credit bureau to obtain the credit freeze. The freeze then must be put on by the credit bureau, and the individual has the opportunity to thaw that freeze and undo the freeze, permanently thaw the freeze, if you will, at a later time, and the procedures for doing that are set forth here in the bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move the A8 amendment, which is a security freeze provision.
Representative Coles moves the A8 amendment. Is there any testimony in favor or opposed to this amendment? Seeing none, questions from members. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Coles, you're on to a complex area, and I'm delighted that you've been doing a lot of work on it. I have just a couple of questions on the... I'm assuming that none of this will prohibit a firm that issues credit from instantaneously acting to close an account or access to an account or verify an account when you know that someone is starting to use your Visa number or your American Express number or whatever, and that they won't be requiring you to go through the process of a police report and filing a security freeze request before they act on that. I don't know what the underlying current statutes are.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, that's correct, at least as far as I understand, and I hope that somebody in the audience will correct me if that's not right, because that's not my intent. It's my intent that what we're dealing with here is when an individual wants to stop their credit report from being distributed on a going forward basis. There are federal law provisions that allow companies, and again, as I mentioned earlier, there's all kinds of financial incentives for companies to stop allowing individuals to charge purchases when they come to learn that there's been a fraud, because the company, the credit card company, is going to be on the hook for it. The rules for the credit card companies and the rules for the credit bureaus, at least as I understand them, they operate together, but they're different. The credit card companies are different than the credit bureaus, and this really deals with how the credit bureaus treat the dissemination of credit reports once somebody has applied for a security freeze. I hope that answers the question.
Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cole, it does. I'm learning as we go along. The other question I had is, in a situation where someone has had, they put a freeze on, I see that there's, you know, some obligations of how fast the credit bureau should act on the request to freeze it. I don't think, a provision that says how fast they should lift it when you have given them the authority to release data to someone. So say you're in a situation where you're applying for a job. I understand many companies do credit checks if you're going to have access to dollars and things like that. And so you're applying for this job, and they say, oh, we did this credit check, and it said we can't share the information. You go, oh, yeah, I got that freeze on. I'll put in a request, tell them that they need to get it to you. But is there any expectation of how quickly that would be lifted on that one-time request?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, I'm searching. Mr. Pender might recall the timelines in the bill.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, on page 2, line 18, it says that they have to comply with the request within 3 business days.
Thank you.
And
Representative Pulse.
I thought I had something intelligent to say, but on further evaluation, I didn't.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, I'm not really understanding totally how this works. This part of the bill. If somebody's, for example, buying a house and find out that they've been a victim of identity theft and suddenly their credit rating is out of whack, they can, and I suppose, get a credit freeze put on, but what good would that do? And under actually any condition, what good would it do that? How would that help them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, in that particular instance, getting the credit freeze is probably not going to help in terms of applying for that loan. And it's not going to do anything to fix that immediate problem. What it is going to stop is it's going to stop your credit report going out to whoever it is who stole your identity and they're seeking to apply for the fourth or fifth or sixth Visa card with your identity. So you still this isn't the answer to every woe that a victim of identity theft is going to have. They're still going to have to go through the process of cleaning up their credit, which is certainly a nightmare and not an easy task to do. Again, that's one of the reasons the identity theft passport provision is in the bill. It's a tool. That's not the answer either, but it's a tool. But this will stop the... So in your situation, you go apply for a mortgage and you find out that, oh my gosh, I had a 720 credit score and now it's 400 and something, and you look into it and you realize that somebody's been taking out credit in your name and not paying the bills. You can put a freeze on your credit report to stop the further issuance of credit. So going forward, it'll stop the further issuance of credit. You're still going to have to, work with the financial institutions and everybody else to clean up. I'm not aware of an easy way to get that done at this point, but this would stop it on a going forward basis.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions to the A8 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A8, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members, that's my bill. I would renew my motion that House File 2843 recommended the pass and sent to the Committee on Civil Law with Representative Adams.
Okay. Representative Coles renews his motion that House File 2843, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to Civil Law. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Coles. As Representative Solberg comes to the table, I think I saw him in here, or if we could have someone go get him. We have a couple of people leave the room. If you could be very quiet so we could do a few things. Just a few housekeeping items. The chair will refer House File 3185 from Representative Mahoney down to the Committee on Technology, Bioscience, and Medical Products. And also, we have one adjustment to the schedule tomorrow. Representative Severson's bill will not be heard. There's some other avenues for that, some of the provisions in that bill. And I would like to put another bill on the calendar, although it's short notice. So we've asked Representative Rukavina if he's ready with House File 12. He's graciously accepted. And that didn't look gracious. Look gracious. And so this is a bill that we've heard before. It passed last year to the House floor and was returned from the General Register. So it shouldn't be controversial. But if you have a lot of amendments, maybe we'd waive the 24-hour rule so Representative Rukavina can amend it if he needs to. Yeah. Or not.
What's
that? We're waiting to hear Representative Solberg's bill on Shamrock Township, which probably should have been heard on next Friday, but we'll hear it early. St. Patrick's Day.
This Friday.
This Friday.
It's McGregor Bank in Shamrock Township.
Representative McDavid's didn't know what the week was.
That's pretty close.
Here it comes.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Representative Sturgis moves that House File 2709 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, I believe. Yes. Representative Silberg, please introduce your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for hearing House File 2709. It's a fairly simple bill that would allow a branch of banking to be located. The bank right now is in McGregor, and it would be located in Shamrock Township. We probably have a resolution from Shamrock Township approving.
Yes,
I have with me John Pastor, the president of the bank?
Chairman of the president.
Chairman of the bank. Chairman of the bank. Okay. One of them will want to speak. I'm out of it,
too. Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Pastor from the State Bank of McGregor. We are asking for this legislation because, one, it's required, and two, we feel that by doing so, it will help the development of Shamrock Township. It is approximately 8 miles north of where we are located in the city of McGregor, and it is currently growing quite rapidly. So that is kind of the reasoning behind it.
For your information, Shamrock Township is a big sandy lake area. So when you've got 65, if you can get up 65, south of McGregor, it's really rough,
mm-hmm.
but maybe in a few years we'll get a smooth road, but we want you to come up anyway.
Generate some economic activity with some more banking.
Right, there you go. But Mr. Chair, the Senate put this on the consent calendar yesterday. So.
Any further testimony? Oh, it is what it is, pretty much. Questions for members? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to one of the witnesses. Have other banks in the area signed off on this? Or are there any banks that would object to this in the area? Or are there no banks in the area?
Representative Silberg or Mr. Passer?
Mr. Chairman, I thought, what was your name?
Representative Davids.
Representative Davids. There are no other banks in the city of McGregor. There is one credit union in the city. There are, I guess, the closest bank to the city of McGregor or to this location will be in Aiken, which is approximately 24 miles away. Grand Rapids, which is about 40 miles. So there are no other banks in the exact area. No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, this has been out for a while. The community knows about it. I met with the credit unions, and they were down for the credit union day last week. None of them expressed any objection to me.
Okay. Further questions? Not. Representative Sturge renews this motion that House File 2709 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Any objection to this consent calendar? We'll amend that motion to refer to the consent calendar. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you. And we are adjourned. You can have lunch.